This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Play along, everybody. Come on. Everybody do the copy machine out here at the State Fair. He is Major Garrett, and very kind. Major has some plans later in the week, and he reached out and said, I can come on Wednesday. And so we love Major. He is with us. He is from... Are you with CBS or NBC? I should know this by now. Is it ABC? Public Access? Who are you?
Columbia Broadcasting System, otherwise known as CBS.
CBS. That is that is correct. He is on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. So, the presidential nominee for the Democrats, Kamala Harris, the reigning vice president, is actually going to sit down for an interview. It has been a long, long time without an interview. We all know the unique circumstances when Joe Biden basically was told by the top power brokers, you're not going to win and you're going to bring us down. And then he stepped away very reluctantly, did not want to be a part of it. And then before anybody really had a chance to run against the vice president, everybody read the tea leaves, and Kamala Harris became the nominee and officially last week. Despite many of us in the media saying, hey, you need to answer questions. You need to answer questions. She did not do that. They would come back and say, why should we? The polling numbers are awfully good. But they have decided to do a joint interview. It is tomorrow with this state's governor, the vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz. It's Dana Bash from CNN. Let me ask you this. There's been a fair amount of talk, and yes, a decent amount of it is from critics saying, now, wait a second. Why isn't it just the presidential nominee herself doing the interview one-on-one as opposed to the presidential nominee and vice presidential nominee together? What is your reaction to that discussion that's taking place now?
So, look, well, I think we've had this conversation before, but I'll reiterate. When politicians, any politician in any race, governor of Minnesota, senator from Wyoming, president of the United States, when any political figure can dictate the terms of engagement with the media, what do? They dictate the terms of engagement, period, full stop. Reporters never stop asking. We always ask for access. We always ask for interviews. And politicians decide on their terms when they can how to engage. If they're trailing, they're behind, if they need more attention, they don't dictate the terms of engagement. But when they're running high, they do. So Kamala Harris said, hey, you guys want to do this right away? Well, I'm going to be in Georgia, and I'm going to be there with my running mate, so I'm going to bring my deflector shield. Okay? Do you want to accept those terms of engagement, or do you not, CNN? And what did CNN say? Yes, we'll accept your terms of engagement. We'll have you and the deflector shield, the vice presidential nominee, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota. And by the deflector shield, I'm not saying that Kamala Harris can't answer questions by herself. I'm sure she can, and I'm sure in the not-too-distant future she will. But having your running mate with you is, by the physicality of it, a deflector shield. It's just, everyone knows it. But she's like, hey, we're going to be in southern Georgia. We're going to talk to you about why we're in southern Georgia. We're not in Fulton County. We're not in Atlanta. We're not in the surrounding counties, which you know are our base of support. No, no, we're going into Trump country. We want to talk to you about why we're in Trump country. And you know why I want to have my running mate with me?
Yep.
Because he's my rural guy. And my rural guy is going to talk about why we're in rural Georgia. So the terms of engagement are, We want to amplify something that we're trying to tell the country, not just Georgia, but the rest of the country. We're in rural America. My rural guy's here, and you take that or leave that. And CNN had to take it.
The funny thing about the rural guy, too, let me just pick up on that, and people in this state are well aware of it. No doubt. I mean, Tim Walz from Nebraska, and then and moved to Mankato and was elected as a congressman in that part of the state. But since Governor Walz became governor, in particular in his last election major, he dominated the metro area. The seven-county area is where Tim Walz won the race. And even though he won decisively defeating Scott Jensen, he was crushed in greater Minnesota. Rural Minnesota, in a resounding way, voted against Tim Walz. They just did. And Tim Walz, and you know this by now, you've studied it, Tim Walz, as a congressman, was clearly a centrist. There's no denying that. I mean, this interview where he and Kristi Noem, both then in Congress, popped up a couple days ago, and they're praising each other. Now, they are diametrically opposed. So it is rather interesting that in this state, nobody would really say, wow, Tim Walz has a lot of support in rural Minnesota. But in America, they're selling that part of the Tim Walz story.
Yeah, look, and I know that first district of Minnesota because I know very well the only other Democrat to represent that district in 120 years, Tim Penny. I covered him when he was in Congress. We wrote two books together, and we have become very dear friends. I don't treat him as a political figure anymore. He doesn't treat me as a journalist anymore. Mm-mm. We're just friends. But I've been to Albert Lea. I've been to New Ulm. I've been to Blue Earth. I've been to Mankato. Sure. I know that district. I know it well. And I know the politics of that district. But when you become governor and the progressive orbit of the party is moving around you and you want to be possibly a national figure, you gravitate in that direction. And it's exactly what Tim Walz did. But on the ticket, Kamala Harris has centered on one city in California, not Berkeley, not San Francisco, Oakland. Working class Oakland. That's the only part of her California resume she wants you to know about. Not Brentwood, where she lived with her husband, Doug Emhoff, in L.A., not San Francisco, where she was the DA. Not Berkeley, right next to Oakland. Oakland. Okay?
Right. So even though she was born in Berkeley and lived in Berkeley for a long time.
But that's all been sort of wiped clean, airbrushed.
Yes, that is correct.
Which is what happens in national campaigns. You stamp your self-image and you ask the people if they're willing to buy it or not. Right now they're willing to buy it, which is one of the benefits of not having to go through a primary, in which people in your own party can say, I'm not buying that. Everyone's buying it in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, they are.
The great question is, will the rest of the country or enough of the rest of the country buy it to propel her to the presidency? So in the meta imagery, Walz passes for rural, even if his political support in rural Minnesota has declined precipitously while governor. That doesn't matter. The imagery is what carries. Oh, that's what they hope will carry.
That's what they're trying to sell. Speaking of great question, let's go this way. Major Garrett is with us. We'll keep Major for a couple segments. We're lucky to have him every time we do. Normally Fridays, 12:35. If you had this assignment, I have no doubt you would have put in a great deal of research. You would have worked on it yourself and your staff. So it's not the easiest question to answer in this case. But if you had the opportunity to sit down and your first two questions were for the presidential nominee, Kamala Harris, the first two questions of a lengthy interview, what would your first two questions be for Kamala Harris?
You can't win the presidency without Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has revived itself economically and diversified itself via hydraulic fracturing. In 2020, you were unequivocally opposed to fracking in every instance. Now you have changed. Why should anyone in Pennsylvania believe your new position? That would be question one.
Yep.
Question two would be, yes, you say you were not the border czar, but you were put in charge of much of the way that the Biden administration thought about and communicated to the country and to the world what our immigration policy is. By the verdict of independent, Republican, and a fair number of Democratic voters for 3.5 years, the opinion of your service in this capacity was decidedly negative. On what basis do you have any credibility to discuss or create new immigration policy after 3.5 years of not only political but policy failure? Those would be my two questions.
Yeah, they're excellent. I'll say I probably would have amplified in your first one. and listed about four of the supposed policy changes from 2019 to where she reportedly is now, because it's not like she said all these positions. It's people close to her or some of the speeches, and just say, why have you changed? Okay, yeah. And why should people believe that? Wait a sec. Are you, once you become, if you win the election, are you the 2019,
right,
2020 Kamala, right, Harris, or are you the 2024? Because these aren't just slight adjustments. There are four, right, or five major positions where she is the exact opposite.
Right. Yeah. I mean, all those things apply.
Yep. No, that's exactly right.
And they feed into the terrain that they least want to go, because they know that the main Trump allegation against her is that not only is she a phony, but she's a potentially dangerous phony. And that's fraught terrain for her. That's why she doesn't want to do a lot of these interviews.
Let's talk Donald Trump, Arlington, what did or did not happen, and also Mark Zuckerberg and what he said about pressure from the Biden administration during COVID. This is a very valid question. The Fabulous Major is back with us in moments. We're at the fair. It's 19 past 1 on CCO.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Let's jump back in with Major Garrett. Major, normally with us on Friday, but Flexible moved his schedule and made adjustments for us. Join us today in the 1 o'clock hour. So you know this. The Republicans, led by Donald Trump, the leader of the party, have been very frustrated talking about censorship, what was and what wasn't out there, including the Hunter Biden story late in the election season. And Mark Zuckerberg has been asked questions about what is allowed in the platform, what is not allowed in the platform, who was taken down initially, maybe on Facebook or Twitter or other platforms. And clearly on the X side, that's changed with Elon Musk. But this story popped up yesterday, and I saved it because I knew we were going to chat about it. So in a letter to Jim Jordan, who's about, about as enthusiastic of a supporter of Donald Trump as you have, he is the head of the Judiciary Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, just battling a cough here. Mark Zuckerberg wrote, in 2021, senior officials from the Biden administration, including the White House, repeatedly pressured our teams for months to censor certain COVID-19 content, including humor and satire, and expressed a lot of frustration with our teams that when we didn't agree. Ultimately, it was our decision whether or not to take the content down. We own our decisions. However, I believe the government pressure was wrong, and I regret that we were not more outspoken about it. I also think we made some choices that, with the benefit of hindsight and new information, we would not make today. If you're Donald Trump and your other Republicans, are you saying, I told you so, and this is a prime example?
Of course they will say, I told you so, and it is an important example. Let me just do something parenthetically. I would summarize every public utterance from Mark Zuckerberg about Facebook or Meta or Instagram or WhatsApp, whether it's congressional testimony about the effect of social media on children, the destruction of local newspapers and media infrastructure as a result of social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, as follows. Jeez, I'm kind of sorry. I wish it hadn't happened. But please avert your eyes while I continue to make billions of dollars gathering and selling your data.
Yes. Yep, that's accurate.
Okay? And this letter conforms precisely with that methodology. Oh, shoot, we kind of blundered. It was sort of a mistake. Wish it hadn't happened. Please avert your eyes while I continue to harvest your data, sell it, and make billions. Okay, point one. Point two. There is an index of outrage that is highly flexible, as many things are in our partisan atmosphere. When Elon Musk took over Twitter and released the Twitter files, it revealed pressure from the Biden administration. It also revealed pressure from the Trump administration. Different topics, but pressure nonetheless. The Biden administration during COVID was aggressive for sure, even about things that were satirical or pseudo-satirical, because they didn't want to take any chances. They can defend that. They can be held politically accountable for that. Mark Zuckerberg tut-tutting about, well, I wish we'd made different choices. And in hindsight, you had all the choices you had to make and available information because it was all yours right in front of you, and you bowed down to government pressure. And you have to own that, Mark Zuckerberg. I always remind people on social media platforms, when you agree to participate, you agree to their terms of service. And their terms of service are highly flexible in terms of what they can or can't or will not do with what you post and its relevance or lack of relevance in the social media space. And their algorithms are theirs. It's their proprietary product. And they will do with your postings what they want. Period. You don't have the rights you assume you have under the Constitution to a First Amendment because it doesn't universally apply. Why? Because it's a private entity and you signed up for that private entity to do what it chooses to do with your content. So in this atmosphere, I'm being censored. No, you're being manipulated by a private entity who, when you signed up for their services, agreed to some form of manipulation. That you may not like it is legitimate. It's a raw human emotion. You can bat it around politically, but you can't call it pure censorship because you agreed to be at least partially censored when you signed on in the first place.
That is well stated. Let's have the broader conversation too. This was an attack, COVID was, on the lives of Americans, on over a million who died.
Yeah.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands who still have long COVID, brought our economy to a screeching halt, and some information that some might determine in their own way was valid and insightful, and others might say that's troubling, that's wrong, and at a time like this, we need to get the most accurate information out there. The question is, what role should the government play? They have the power of the government to put out an extraordinary amount of information, but they know we have so many forms of communication, including Facebook, including then Twitter, including Insta. So I get where it depends upon too often where you stand, where if you disagree with those people in the presidency, you're going to say, come on, free speech. What are you doing? This is not censorship. This is not an area for government expression. And if you agree with those politicians, you're saying, now, wait a second. This isn't just normal dialogue. This is our friends, our neighbors, our relatives are dying. And we need to use all the communication sources to get the best information out there. And if the government needs to step in certain circumstances, they should. It's a hard line to draw. But sadly, as you know, Major, most people are drawing that line now if they agree with the politician who's drawing the line.
Right. So this is not the same as going to the town square, getting on your soapbox, and giving a speech. Social media, by its very technological nature, amplifies, okay, and accelerates information, misinformation, and disinformation. And let me just get technical for one second.
Yep.
The governing regulation is Section 230 of a law passed in the late 1990s about the Internet. And unlike you, Chad, and WCCO, unlike me at CBS, or unlike any news organization I work for, CNN, Fox, U.S. News and World Report, The Washington Times, any local newspaper I worked at, all of those are publishers who are not covered by Section 230. What does Section 230 say? Social media companies and Internet companies cannot be sued. They are not publishers. They cannot be held to any legal standard whatsoever for what they publish and accelerate and amplify. They are completely immune in ways that you are not and ways I am not. We have to be careful.
Correct.
We have to exercise editorial judgment and discretion. And if we don't, we can be hauled into court, and properly so.
Yeah.
Properly so. And social media companies don't have that. They don't have that fear at all. So the government at times has to look at this and say, wait a minute, there are equities here. There are risks involved, and there's nothing we can do to hold them accountable any other way than to get on the phone and say, hey, look at all this crap.
Yeah, right.
Are you sure you're comfortable with this? We're not comfortable with it. We're actually trying to fight a battle against an infectious disease that's killing people by the tens, the dozens, the hundreds, the thousands, fill in the blank. And so it is a gray area. And your, like I said, volatility index, your anger management issues often fall on partisan lines. The Trumpists don't care that the Trump administration pressured Twitter, but they care that the Biden administration did.
Yes.
Similarly, Democrats don't care that the Biden administration did, but they care that Trump did. Okay.
That is correct.
So that's where we are.
About 90. Donald Trump is looking at Afghanistan and the 13 individuals who perished. A day that the Biden administration looked foolish, unprepared on a topic we discussed on this show for months and months and months. We also have pointed out that Donald Trump had put in a lot of those parameters, that Donald Trump had forced the Afghanistan government to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners, that Donald Trump was willing at one point to meet with the Taliban at Camp David.
Mm-hmm.
We can't forget all those things. But Donald Trump is trying to make political hay over what was a moment of incompetence for Joe Biden administration, and he goes to, you know, Arlington National Cemetery to honor, respect, and also campaign. What what was your view about what happened, including the potential of some sort of confrontation?
There was a confrontation of some kind. There was some belief upon the one, at least one staffer at Arlington National Cemetery, that lines had been crossed, that politicization was going on at a sacred place of honor for all American service personnel who died in the service of our country. Yes, Trump was invited by the Gold Star, at least some of the Gold Star families, to be there, and they did not object to his presence or what he was doing there. But that's not enough. There are universal rules, and there is a federal law that says nothing political or that could be turned into political can be filmed or photographed at Arlington National Cemetery. It cannot be. Even if you're invited by some of those families whose loved ones are buried at Arlington, that's not good enough.
Right.
Okay. And there was clearly something that crossed a line. Afghanistan is a legitimate issue. On the takeout this weekend, I'm interviewing a documentarian who's just created a film called Hollywood Gate. His name is Ibrahim Musharraf, and he spent a year with the Taliban after the U.S. withdrew, and it's not a pretty picture. And the sorrows of Afghanistan begin in the George W. Bush administration and run through every administration up to and including Joe Biden's, and that's a fact.
I will look forward to that. I encourage everyone to check out The Takeout on a regular basis. It is a brilliant podcast. Thank you for flexibility, sir. We'll talk to you next week.
Have a great Labor Day.
The fabulous Major Garrett.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.